So the director's out of town, and I don't see the deputy director. So I guess I'll be the deputy director and introduce myself. I'm Joe Polchinski, and I'm a permanent member here. And what I'll be talking about, cosmic strings and superstrings, is fun for an audience like this because it involves many different kinds of physics. So whenever I see pictures of galaxies, such as at the Lens Conference, got your galaxy that everybody else cares about, and I'm always imagining that somewhere invisible in the picture, there's this giant loop of string, or maybe even a strand of string, crossing the entire field, the entire visible universe. So what are these strings? Well, in fact, one-dimensional objects arise all over the place in quantum field theory, not to mention string theory. The canonical example is just the Aberkasov flux tubes in superconductors, where you have a broken U1 symmetry. You have the BCS field with a potential like that, and so it has a ring of minima. And so the theory supports a vortex solution, where as you circle the vortex, the field goes once around the ring of minima. So this has got some kind of topological winding, and therefore stability. But by continuity, as you shrink the circle, the field has to go over the top, and so there's a defect in the middle. And for these particular defects, there's also running down the middle magnetic flux. So these, of course, are seen in superconductors, but many extensions of the standard model grand unified theories have such a symmetry breaking pattern, and so can support these objects. But also, in string theory, you have the strings themselves, the things that you quantize to get gravity and everything. I'll call them F for fundamental, to distinguish them from even other objects like the D strings, related to them by various duality symmetries. And there's other kinds of one-dimensional objects as well. String theories, by the way, contain quantum field theories, so they may have these ordinary objects in them. These magnetic flux tubes, which are just classical solutions for this effective potential, were the original cosmic strings that were discussed 20 years ago, which I'll come back to later on. And these are more exotic things that you might get in string theory, and there are more exotic things still, higher dimensional objects, which are partly wrapped on hidden dimensions, so you see only one of their dimensions. Now, for most of my talk, it really doesn't matter which of these we're talking about. Any of them would be very exciting, and then it would be interesting to see if we could figure out which it was. But since we're talking about something whose length is cosmic and whose thickness in any case is microscopic, any of these is basically a perfect one-dimensional object. And the only real property that it has, well, it has a mass per unit length, which I'll call mu. And it also has a tension, T. And because of Lorentz invariance for any of these objects, these things are actually equal, at least in units where C equals 1. And I'm not going to try to put in the C's correctly. So that's pretty much all you need to know about these objects to define their dynamics. Now the real question is, how do they form? How did they get? So these especially, we think of as being little Planck-sized loops. And all of these are connected with very short scales in physics. So how did they ever get to be that big? So part of the story, of course, is the whole universe expanded, and they expanded along with it. But in fact, there's more that has to happen than that. And the simplest way to make a string like this is a mechanism due to Kibble. It's very similar to what happens again in real phase transitions, where it can very easily be that early in the universe, that early in the universe, whatever field it is that has this symmetry breaking potential, and by the way, while I'm on the subject, I can show you a nice walnut symmetry breaking potential made by our postdoc, Florian DeBoth. He can do anything with U1 symmetry, and I believe he can even break the symmetry. You'll have to ask him about that. Anyway, it's often the case that in the very early universe, the potential is, is an unbroken symmetry, a unique minimum, and then as the temperature, due to thermal effects or due to the evolution of other fields, as time goes on, the form of the potential changes, and you have a phase transition from unbroken to broken symmetry. So these objects exist whenever the symmetry is broken, and in fact they form whenever a symmetry becomes broken, because early on, the potential is just sitting at the unique minimum at zero. Once the potential changes, it has to roll to a minimum. And by causality, it won't be over sufficiently long distances, it won't be correlated. It will roll in different directions. And so after the phase transition, the field rolls down, the dust clears, you look at what you've got. Inevitably, again, just by causality, it will have chosen directions such that there are defects. There are regions of trapped winding. And so if you, in fact, simulate this, or even there are various analog dense matter systems, then what you find after the transition is a gas of loops of string. But also, you find, no matter how large the simulation volume, that there are some strings that form that extend from one side to the other. And maybe as you increase the simulation volume, this remains true. Roughly 50% of the string, give or take, is in small loops, and roughly 50% is in the form of these long, effectively infinite strings. It's easy to see why you have to form infinite strings. Again, by causality, essentially, over a sufficiently long distance, the direction is uncorrelated. It's basically a random walk, and in three dimensions, a random walk has a finite probability not to come back close to its starting point, and so it just goes on forever. So curiously, forming objects much, much larger than the causality scale, the horizon scale, is not forbidden but actually required when you have a transition of this type. So that's how you would make this kind of string, the field theory string. Now, for these kinds of strings, they seem a lot, of course, more mysterious. And so I'll draw stranger pictures. It's long been a question of how, in string theory, you would realize inflation in a nice way, how you could use the ingredients that you have in string theory to get the right kind of potential. And one thing that seems very attractive in general is the idea of brain inflation. So string theory has in it these higher dimensional objects. And it's quite possible that there are some of the, so these, all, everything I'm drawing here is extended in the three large directions, the directions that we see, but then localized in one or more of the small compact directions. And so it's an idea been floating around for the last 10 or so years that most of the degrees of freedom that we see are stuck on such a brain in the compact dimensions. But also, having an extra brain, an anti-brain in the early universe is a natural way to drive inflation. They have potential energy, which will cause the universe to expand, and they have the right kind of potential, more or less, to slowly attract and then rapidly annihilate, which is what you need to generate slow roll inflation. And so, this is not my main subject, but there's a fair number of string theorists making models of inflation kind of picture. And the nice thing pointed out by Henry Tai and his students is that so these things come together, they annihilate into radiation, as the inflaton field must, but also they form strings, both the fundamental strings in general and also various dual strings. And actually there's a simple reason why they do, because it's not so different than this story. So this is the Kibble mechanism in field theory. And again, this is Tai et al. But in fact, if you just look at the effective four-dimensional Lagrangian for this, so each of these geometric ingredients has some four-dimensional field. The separation is a field, and there's fields that represent the symmetry breaking. In fact, the four-dimensional Lagrangian that describes roughly what's happening there is of the same type, exactly the same as in the field theory. And so the same kind of causality reasoning would say that you would form this gas of strings, and in particular, the infinite strings. All right, please interrupt me with questions if you have them. Yes?
How does it relate to the Ekperonic universe?
Okay. So they also use the brains to try to find an alternative. This is conservative in the sense that it just uses kind of ordinary low-energy physics that we think we understand. The Ekperonic universe, requires that, well, it's more than just the brains. It's the entire sort of the brains bound to interval. It's the entire interval which shrinks and then is supposed to expand again in a smooth way, such that perturbations travel through that, not much modified. And this, there's a moment here where general, so here, in some sense, low energy effective field theory is always valid. Here there's a moment where the curvature is infinite, low energy effective field theory has broken down. You can make an argument that to some zeroth order approximation, this bounce may exist, but every sign is that it's unstable. So it's an undecided question because things are so nonlinear. But this, in terms of just the dynamics, this is at this point much more speculative than this.
When you said that there are always strings going from, say, one end to the other.
Yes. Yes.
That is assuming that the system has least looked at the rapid transition.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, more or less, right. There's a rapid, that this process has equilibrated, right. Okay. Yes?
Okay, you say the field theory string and the string theory strings are described by the same kind of Lagrangian, but yeah. I don't see in the case of string theory how the symmetry is breaking. So in the field theory, okay, you do have a symmetry breaking. In string theory, you have something like okay, un cross un for brain, for un, and the brain.
All right. Let me give you a short answer, and maybe a longer answer later on. The short answer is that if these are D-brains, there are other kinds of brains, but if these are D-brains, which are my favorite, then each of them has on it a U1 gauge field. And in the process of the brains disappearing, two U1 gauge symmetries disappear. And it's more complicated than in field theory because you really can't separate it out to a finite number of degrees of freedom. But the level of what the topology is, and we should talk about this afterwards, it seems pretty clear for both U1s, this effective argument holds, and therefore you'd form two kinds of string. But this is getting to technical points that we should discuss, string theory that we should discuss later on. Okay. So actually for almost any kind of one-dimensional object that would arise in any of these theories, there's an analogous process, which is rough. I mean, in some rough sense, it's some dual version of the Kibble process. Now, by the way, one nice thing about the D-brain inflation is it forms one-dimensional defects and not zero-dimensional or two-dimensional. That is not magnetic monopoles and not domain walls. And that's good because, as I'll discuss, strings are interesting. The zero-dimensional and two-dimensional defects are problems. They would overclose the universe. They would kind of dominate the other energies. And so they're excluded. So it's nice that this process produces exactly the things that are potentially interesting. So what happens next? So we have this phase transition of one of these types. It forms these very early in the universe. And by very early, I mean, well, not before inflation, because if this happened before inflation, then inflation would just dilute all of these things away, as it does for magnetic monopoles. But ideally, as soon after inflation as possible, because, as I'll discuss, the main signatures of these things are gravitational. And so you'd like them to be associated with the highest possible energy scale, meaning as close to inflation as possible. And happily, many cosmologists like hybrid inflation, in which inflation terminates in exactly this kind of phase transition that would make these strings, and the brain models of inflation are just geometric realizations of this kind of hybrid inflation. I'll mention it. I mean, in these models, you know, the kind of inflation that one has correlates with the things that are observable in other ways. The specific models here have very small values of R, the tensor to scalar ratio in the CMV, and they also have n sub s, the slope of around 0.98, which is slightly on the high side of W map, but in the range. So these models have property, so have characteristic properties that you can see both in the CMB, but also they make strings. Now, after the strings form, the universe expands for a while, and there is a model-dependent thing that can happen that's bad, and it's very, very much sensitive to details of the model. There are a couple of things that can happen that would cause the network to go away rather than growing to cosmic size. Under some conditions, long strings can break into short open strings, and the whole thing turns into dust. And in some conditions, they're confined, but we'll just assume that doesn't happen. That's sort of the big model-dependent question in the subject. And we'll suppose that they survive, they expand along with the universe, and what happens next? So, we draw one picture. I'm not sure how much I'll use it later on, but it's useful in thinking about these things. So, we're interested again in the strings that start out as basically infinite random walks because they seed everything that happens later on. And there's more than one of them. Now, as the universe expands on long scales, this is a co-moving picture. So the picture doesn't change. All lengths get bigger at some rate, which depends on what epoch you're in. But the lengths get larger more slowly than the horizon grows. The horizon, the distance over which you can see, grows linearly in t. So you picture some kind of dashed box, which represents a horizon scale. And on scales long compared to that, the structure is frozen in and just expands with the universe. As the box grows relative to the other scales and string comes inside the box, it starts to oscillate, move around. It straightens because the oscillations redshift away. So the dynamics happens on distances of the horizon scale and less. So what happens, well, let's see, one thing, so there'll be more than one of these long strings crossing a horizon. What happens, first of all, is that long strings interconnect. They intercommute. So that means when two of them collide, they reconnect. Actually, there's two things they can do. So here, the two long strings have reconnected, and so this one goes this way and this one goes that way. It's also possible they pass through one another. Actually, here is the one place where what's going on in the core matters. Because, for most purposes, these are so thin compared to their length. The core doesn't matter. When they collide, the core certainly does matter. So either of these can happen. This happens with a probability we'll call P for the reconnection, and 1 minus P that they pass through one another. And if you only had two models of string, you could actually distinguish them with this, because the old-fashioned cosmic strings, the magnetic flux tubes, the gauge theory solitons, have P equals 1. Whereas the fundamental strings, the strings that you quantize to get gravity, this is a quantum process, and it happens with a probability G squared. So if you only had two models and you could find these strings, you could actually differentiate them. Now, there's not just two models, and with just one parameter, you're not going to differentiate 100 models, but it shows you that you can actually do more than find these. You can start to ask questions about their microscopic properties. Anyway, the long strings will reconnect with some probability. Also, this could in fact be two strands of the two bits of the same long string. So I got to draw it like this. So it could be that this is the real picture. And then again, with probability p, it will form a loop. So loops form. So long strings intercommute, loops form. And finally, the loops decay to gravitational radiation.
What is the thickness of these strings?
You're talking about thickness in the thin direction?
Just one fundamental.
Or length. Sorry, thickness or length?
No, diameter.
This way?
Yes.
Really small. you know, gut scale. Gut scale. Or QCD scale. But no, for the ones I'm talking about, the ones that have gravitational signatures, it will be gut scale.
Can both dimensions expand with the inverse or just the length?
No, the thickness does not expand. The thickness is some intrinsic scale, like any scale in physics that doesn't change, but the length is something which is stretchable.
Right. Can you draw your strings with arrows? Do they have arrows in all theories?
No, in fact, there are strings that don't have arrows. There are strings that don't have arrows. I didn't need to clutter the picture with them except.
There'd be a third resolution possible?
So in the ones without arrows, there would be also the third process. Right, right.
Can you also draw a single corner after the crossing?
Yes, actually, so this is an interesting, so one effect of the long string intercommutations, when they form, they instantaneously have a corner. And strings in flat space, and by the time, well, strings in flat space, and for many purposes, once they start inside the horizon, you can think of them as flat space strings, have a very simple dynamics. Everything is just the sum of a right-moving and left-moving wave, which doesn't dissipate. And so the corners just, each corner separates into a right-moving corner and left-moving corner, but the corners, which are called kinks, retain their structure. And this it's interesting for a number of reasons. For one thing, it means that the long strings, even after they start to stretch, this process gives them some kind of short distance, non-smooth structure. Right. So, the net effect of, so there's three processes. There's really only three processes other than just simply the actual kinetic motion in curved space-time, the intercommutation of long strings with each other, with themselves, and the decay of the loop by gravitational radiation. And fairly robustly over a wide range of initial conditions, parameters, and so on, it seems that the networks scale, which means that if you look at it on a box of the horizon size, so in terms of the co-moving size, this is growing in time. But if you look at a box of the horizon size, at any given time, you always see the same statistical distribution. You see a few dozen long strings crossing the volume, and then some kind of gas of loops. And what the simulations show is that independent of the initial conditions, this is kind of an attractor. So as the horizon grows, you see more and more of the original string, but these processes basically make it disappear at the maximum rate allowed by causality, so that on the horizon scale, the network always looks more or less statistically the same.
Why are the strings curved?
Well, they started curved because they were random walks. That's how they formed, like by causality. And as they come inside the horizon, they start to wiggle, but the curvature is slowly damped, though it's also restored by the intercommutation process. So, OK. So the network scales, one interesting property of it is that the strings move rather relativistically. If this was flat space, the virial theorem would tell you that v squared is a half. That is a half c squared. And it's a little bit less than that because the expansion of the universe redshifts energy away. But they're still moving at a pretty good fraction of the speed of light. So potential wells, like potential wells of galaxies, are irrelevant to them. Okay, so assuming that, again, we have the right kind of inflation to produce these, assuming that they don't decay in any way, then this is what's sitting out there today. And the question is, how would we see it? And, okay, or how will we see it? What are the bounds? Now, I'm going to focus on what are the most generic strings whose only interactions are gravitational. There are other possibilities. It's possible that the strings emit axions, which can make them either harder to see or easier, at least lead to some interesting effects. But these are harder to make. There are thoughts that perhaps strings could emit interesting cosmic rays, interesting levels of cosmic rays. But these all, it seems hard to make, to get an interesting level of cosmic rays out of them. Also, there are superconducting strings which interact strongly with low energy gauge fields and have an interesting phenomenology which is very different from what I'm talking about. But I want to focus on the ones that have just gravitational interactions. And since they have just gravitational interactions, there's only one parameter that matters, which is the tension. And that's a mass per length. So g mu, the tension times Newton's constant, is dimensionless. And this dimensionless number you can think of in two different ways. First of all, it's the string tension in Planck units. So it tells you how close you are to, you know, short distance scales. For fundamental strings, we used to think this number had to be pretty close to 1. But as we've understood more general models in the last 10 years, there's a much wider range of possibilities. And in particular, for the brain inflation models, they tend to lie in this range. The fact that this is less than 1 is correlated with the fact that we know that the scale of inflation has to be below the Planck scale. This is correlated with the scale of inflation, and that's not Planckian. So this isn't Planckian either. I thought of trying to translate this into ordinary units, and I forgot to. But what g mu of about 10 to the minus 6th is what you would get if you took the Earth and you squashed it into a one-dimensional object. That's about the mass per unit length that these things have. So, you know, a one-dimensional object with just the length of the diameter of the Earth.
So the plus mass is 10 to the minus 5 grams. So this would be 10 to the minus 5 grams per each
angle. Per Planck length. Per 10 to the minus 5 grams per 10 to the minus 32 centimeters. So you can do the division. Yeah. Okay. Also, another way you can think about this number is it's just the typical metric perturbation produced by the string. It's the coupling of the string to gravity, so it's the typical metric perturbation. For example, a string will bend light. The geometry around a string is around a straight string is essentially a perfect cone. String will bend light. And so you'll see if you have an object at infinity, two images, and this angle here is 8 pi g mu. And I'll say more about lensing later on. But again, just two ways to think about the meaning of this dimensionless parameter.
Question here.
Yes?
So how can we calculate the mean energy density contributed by string?
Good, I'll come to that. Thank you.
And the second thing,
yes,
as time goes on, actually eventually the universe will be dominated by string because, you know, you as it expands, actually you have one dimension that stretches. And
two very good questions. And I will answer them quite shortly.
Okay.
Good, good. Right. So given this, the possible gravitational signatures that come to mind are, as has just been mentioned, dark matter. Effects on the CMB, lensing, and gravitational waves. Okay, so as far as dark matter, in this scaling solution, the density in strings, in cosmic strings, divided by the density in whatever is dominant, the matter or the radiation, is actually a constant. It doesn't grow with time. You're correct that if the strings did just stretch, because they're one-dimensional, their energy density would grow and it would come to dominate. And there was a brief period, I forget when, in the late 90s maybe, when the dark energy was consistent with W equals minus a third, and there were, which is what you would get from one-dimensional objects. And so there were a few papers proposing this. But because of the processes I mentioned, stretching, loop formation, and gravitational radiation decay, the fact that these things are decaying at the maximum rate allowed by causality actually translates into the statement that they don't, their proportion of the energy doesn't grow in time. And it's proportional to the tension of the string. It's of order 100 times this dimensionless parameter. So since this is no larger than 10 to the minus 6, these are not the dark matter. There are, again, very exotic, not fully understood models in which it could, in which tiny loops carrying currents could be the dark matter. But in the standard scenario, they're you know, not an important. There's enough of them that they have interesting signatures, but they're not the dominant energy. So this one is not over to see them. Okay, the CMB. Now, there was a period of about 10 years, more or less ending, I guess, with COBE, when cosmic strings were actually a candidate for the origin of structure. So you need scale invariant perturbations. And the scaling property of the string network, in fact, translates into the statement that the perturbations they produce are scale invariant. And so for g mu of around, the number is roughly 3 times 10 to the minus 6, or thereabouts, the perturbations that are produced by strings have the roughly the right magnitude and spectrum to produce structure. And this was very exciting for a while, and it didn't work. It didn't work because, well, the simplest way to see it is just in the power spectrum from the CMB. Here's, you know, the acoustic peaks. And that's what you get from Jacobi et al. And that's what you get from lambda CDM, whereas strings give something more like this, a single broad peak. The reason is that they act very differently in time. The perturbations from inflation form very early, and when they come inside the horizon, they start ringing, whereas the perturbations from strings are produced after the scales re-enter the horizon, and so there's not this same, you know, coherence in time. And so COBE quickly made, already at the low end of the spectrum, it was pretty clear that this wasn't working. And so now instead of this being a model of structure formation, it becomes a bound. How much of the string curve could you mix with lambda CDM and still fit? And so the bound that you get from the CMB is now g mu less than around 2.3 times 10 to the minus 7. Okay, lensing. So I just told you what the bound is from the CMB, and that's come down in the last year, both due to improved calculation and due to the third year data from WMAP. But if you translate that into a lensing angle, this is like 1.2 seconds. So you're right at approaching the limit for optical lensing. In fact, there have been, over the years, first in the late 80s and then in the last few years, reports of candidate cosmic string lenses with separations of about 2 seconds. Now, actually 2 seconds isn't impossible because that's that's the lens angle for a static string and with the object at infinity. If you move the object closer, the lens angle goes down. If you tilt the string, the lens angle goes down. But because these things are moving rather fast, relativistic effect can enhance them. So that's an estimate rather than a precise number for what the lens angle would be. And it could produce lenses of 2 or 3 or 4 seconds of arc occasionally. Well, as you can see from the bound, though, this possibility is on the verge of being irrelevant, but I'll say a few words about what the lenses look like just for fun. If you have a galaxy just behind the string, then you get 2 translated, not reflected, but translated images. And if the string is straight, they're perfect images. It's more interesting if the galaxy is not right behind the string, because then you only get part of one image. You get a full galaxy here and kind of a sliced off part of a galaxy there. So that would be pretty distinctive if you saw it. And as I said, there was a candidate like this, which was supposed to be very good, and not surprisingly, it turned out to be a binary galaxy. Again, 20 years ago, there were 4 candidates, none of them very good, but there were 4 of them, and they were, I guess, all binary galaxies. So, anyway.
So for a moving string, no.
Good. A moving string would not produce any interesting effect except a very tiny differential redshift.
Yeah.
But So if the string is the differential redshift is roughly this number, because it's for a relativistic velocity. Right. There's another thing though. We talked briefly about the kinks and the fact that simulations show that these strings have some kind of short distance structure. And so there's small literature on the possibility that the strings, instead of being effectively straight at short distance, are more like random walks on the scale of lensing. So instead of having fractal dimension 1, like a string, they'd have fractal dimension 2, like a random walk. In that case, not surprisingly, you would get multiple images of different sizes. It's kind of fun to think about, but I'll tell you later on,
that's almost surely wrong.
The strings on distances this small, seconds of arc, are straight, such as that the difference in the two images would be something at the order of the percent level. Question? Okay. So, I'm sorry, when I talked about this, thank you, I forgot. I talked about the effect of the strings on the power spectrum, but you might think that the easiest way to look for a string would be to look for a line, which is a little redder on this side and bluer on this side, because that's what a string will do if it's moving transverse to you. It will. And there have been searches on that basis, pattern searches, Zhang and Smoot and Low and Wright, I think, are the relevant names. Anyway, the pattern searches are less sensitive than the power spectrum. The power spectrum is really a very good way to look for strings. Also, just by the effect on the spectrum, it tends to spoil the black body. You actually get a bound which is still a little less sensitive than the direct power spectrum bound. Yeah. Polarization, these things will produce polarization because the strings, unlike the cosmic microwave, unlike inflation, it produces vector and tensor perturbations along with scalar perturbations. And so, not yet, but I guess there's something called CMB pole, which is supposed to look for polarization very sensitively, and through the polarization signal, improve on this a little bit.
What's the magnitude?
It's probably vector modes that turn up in the B modes. I should refer you to the paper, but it's by Seljak and various collaborators.
What is the optimal distance for lensing the string
to be? I think, isn't it always true for lensing that the closer the better, because as it moves further, as it gets closer to the object, the angle goes down? I think that's how it works. Good. So good question. In fact, I'll come back to this in a second, but if you take this and translate it into a distance, you're talking about something like 10 to the 6 light years or more, typical distance to the nearest string. So not nearby lensing. Right. Yeah, they're pretty rare, but they're not so rare that you can't see them, as I'll... there is one more lensing type observation, which I'll mention since there's, I guess, you know, people here who know much more about this than me. But I'll just tell you before I say anything that I do not take it seriously at all. There's this lens quasar that Schild. Okay. I can stop there? Okay. I'll just tell you anyway. Lens quasar, in which the A and the B images both have oscillations, but they're not 400 or 500 days out of phase as they would be with the object. They're in the same phase as though it was some nearby object. And the claim is that the parameters don't fit a binary star. So they both oscillate. There were like 5 of these, and then it stopped. And the claim is, so that this could be produced by a nearby binary of some sort that was, or by a rotating string. Anyway, I have no idea about the astronomy, but the parameters that this would have to have for, if it were a string, is something like 1 in a billion. Because I just told you that the nearest one is probably 10 to the 6th light years, and that would have to be 10 to the 3rd light years, and the parameters are in other ways strange. But anyway, this has been billed as a possible observation of cosmic string, but not by me.
So the metric perturbations you're saying, like a third order 10 to the minus
7. So the, roughly this times 25, say. So
right. So when strings pass through a galaxy, like, would you think
of
a galaxy?
It's relativistic, let me take as a typical number 10 to the minus 10th, because that's probably the most likely number. For the simplest models, that's the number you get. So if one of these passed through you, your head and your feet would start to move towards each other with a velocity of about 10 to the minus 8th c, which is... not so much, right? That's like 30 feet. Right? You can, yeah, 30 meters per second. That's pretty bad. Pretty bad. You don't want this to happen to you. Okay. And yeah. So these things are rare. Of course, these things are rare enough that that's hard to see. But imagine it passed through a distant galaxy. Would you be able? Again, you're talking about velocities of 10 to the minus 8th. At the upper end, 10 to the minus 5.
The upper end, like,
you might be able to see that would be. Yeah. There may be clever ways. I'm talking about the canonical ways to see these things, and there may be clever ways that people haven't thought of. Henry Tai, who has been working on these for several years now, and has really been the one who more than anyone else has pushed this subject, has been talking about possibilities of microlensing. Now, you'd have to have one pretty close to see stars behind it, but you'd see microlensing of stars. Anyway, there might be clever ways to see these. I'm talking about the brute force ways. Okay, so good. I'm moving through my outline pretty fast. Gravitational waves. So this is the signature that has a real chance to improve the bounds substantially over the existing ones. So these loops that form, they emit all of their energy in the models in which they don't couple to other things, ends up as gravitational waves. And actually, in the phenomenology, it's worth noting that there are two kinds of waves you get. There are low frequency waves, basically with wavelengths of order the size of the object. And due to nonlinear effects, there are also cusps that form on the strings, which emit higher frequency waves of frequency much higher than the size of the object. And so in the phenomenology, both of these are important. Which is more important depends on a lot of things. But in particular, actually, I guess now is the time to mention the fact that these networks are not really that well understood. So in the simulations, everybody pretty much agrees on the number of long strings. And that's what's important for the CMB, because the long strings act most coherently and make the dominant contribution to the, you know, to the CMB, to the perturbation of the geometry of the universe. But clearly, the gravitational waves they depend heavily on what the loops are doing. And what's amazing is that people have been studying these networks for 20 years. It's a purely deterministic problem, just strings moving in curved space and then reconnecting when they cross. And we can even say P equals 1 exactly to keep things simple. They always reconnect. And there is a 25 order of magnitude disagreement on this purely deterministic classical problem. A 25 order of magnitude disagreement on the sizes of the loops that form, which is amazing. The reason for this is, first of all, that the initial thought was there's one scale on the problem, the horizon size, and all loops would form at the horizon size or a tenth, you know, something at that scale. And what simulation showed is that they instead formed at the smallest scales that the simulation could reach, at the UV cutoff. And there were arguments that this has to do with the fact that there's this kinked structure on the strings, that they're not totally smooth. And so people had to guess what the real scale was. And so in the literature, even today, for the loop size, as a fraction of the horizon size, you will find strong support for, so when people realized that the loops were seeming to form at the UV cutoff, they figured that what happened was they would always do that until you got to some new physics. And the new physics is gravitational radiation. And so the canonical guess for a long time was that the size of the loops was parametrically smaller than the horizon scale. And because it depends on gravitational radiation, it depends on the coupling of the string to the metric. Although even this is subtle, because in fact, it's more likely that this is the right physics. The number is actually something like 50 g mu to the 5/2, because of the subtleties in the radiation formula. But more recently, simulations have given numbers more like 10 to the minus 4. And the latest, and nobody agrees on this, the latest claim is as large, in fact, as 1/10 of the horizon scale. So there's your 25 or so order of magnitude disagreement. And nobody knows the answer. I got into the subject. I figured I'm a string theorist. These are strings. I should be able to figure this out. And you know, 2 years, as with anything when you get into a new subject, you start to learn how hard it is. And so 2 years later, I'm just one more person arguing with the other ones. Anyway, it's really fascinating. So let me just say, I'm actually pretty much on time for a soft landing. So let me just say a few words about how about the bounds and this unknown parameter enters into them. So. The low frequency gravitational waves, this is the primary uncertainty in their magnitude. The high frequency gravitational waves depend even more sensitively on the short distance structure of the strings. And again, so where you might see these, of course, would be interferometers, LIGO, LISA, and so on, or through pulsar timing. Because you have these random gravitational waves in space, the signals from pulsars are coming to us through them. And the regularity of those signals tells us that space is pretty flat and puts in fact very good bounds on any kind of random gravitational wave background. So for the low frequency waves, which are kind of easier to parameterize, the fractional contribution to the energy density, the total energy density per logarithmic frequency scale is about 10 to the minus 3 times this unknown loop size times the string tension to the 1/2. And this is a number which has is best measured at pulsars right now. And the measure, the limit has actually been kind of uncertain. It has recently been improved. There's this Parkes pulsar timing array in Australia, which is following a bunch of pulsars over time. And this number is less than now about 4 times 10 to the minus 8th, which if I've done my arithmetic right, for the number that I thought was right, this is not a very sensitive bound yet. This is about 2 times 10 to the minus 6th, which is an order of magnitude weaker than the bounds from the CMB. But for the highest possible scale, which again comes from a very good group, it's a group at Tufts, and they're very clever and don't make silly mistakes, the bound would already be 2 orders of magnitude stronger than the bound from the CMB. So the bound from the CMB is relatively robust because it doesn't depend much on this uncertainty. So nobody knows what the bounds are. It seems pretty clear. Okay, over time, the Parkes array is going to go down to about 10 to the minus 10, and LISA is supposed to go down to about 10 to the minus 11, and there's a square kilometer array that's supposed to look for pulsars, it's supposed to go down to 10 to the minus 12. So more or less independent of this uncertainty, these future instruments should pretty much probe the entire scale of tensions that's relevant for these brain inflation models, but it's hard to say exactly when because of this. Also, if you see this, the first thing you see is just a stochastic background, a random background of gravitational waves, which can come from lots of things. Not from inflation, actually, because that's a lower magnitude than this. But hopefully, if you see the stochastic background, then you can start looking for the higher frequency signals, which have a much more interesting time signature. Or also, in this case, there may be a slope in the spectrum. So if you see a stochastic background, you don't know right away that it's cosmic strings, but OK, then there's lots more work to do. Yeah?
Also see spectrum scale
in there? OK, good. The spectrum. The spectrum is scale invariant for a while. So what you have to, for most of the range of parameter space, one is seeing gravitational waves that were emitted during the radiation era, and all of those were redshifted by the same amount during matter. I mean, relative. However, as you go to lower tensions, higher frequencies, you're starting to see waves that were emitted during the matter era, and so they've suffered less redshifting, and so that you get a tilt in the spectrum. So depending on where you are in terms of string tension, it's the spectrum is flat in the LIGO and LISA ranges, and the pulsar range is right around where the kink is. So it depends on parameters. Yeah.
Other models that it might be possible to measure the gravitational waves from the phase transition itself, or the far.
Those are very high frequency, and I don't know anything about this except that Richard Easter was telling me he thinks there might be way. I mean, I don't know this subject. There are claims that there may be clever ways to see higher frequency, much higher frequency gravitational waves than people have looked for, but that's only hearsay.
So which frequencies? I mean, does this mean like 10 to the 4 or higher?
I think he means much higher, and the person to ask is again Richard Easter. Okay, so. So in my last 5 minutes, just or less even. So again, this is a very frustrating subject, partly because, well, everybody works on it part time because, you know, nope, this is a cult thing. You don't earn your living at cosmic strings. You do it, you know, in your spare time. But also, the simulations take a long time to run. It's very hard to compare two different simulations. And whenever any group finds a different result from a different group, they always say the other group had transients. And so, you know. How can you respond to that? No, you have transients. Anyway, so in particular, this group, which is seeing the largest loops, is claiming that all of the other, that the small loops are transients, that if you watch the networks for longer, their population dies away, and you see this population of large loops. It's surprising, because small loops are associated with small timescales, And so you'd think that if they were transient, they would die away very fast. It just really reflects how little understanding people have of these networks. This problem is a lot like turbulence because it has too many scales to really simulate, and it's too nonlinear to do anything analytic. Anyway, my student George Rocha and I have tried to think about it analytically. And we realized that if you sort of turned off one process, the loop formation, then you could kind of make a scaling argument. It still requires sort of some ignoring some correlations, making some mean field estimates. But if you plot the fractal dimension of the string as a function of the distance along the string, here's log x, and this is the horizon scale, log t, and this is 2, which is a random walk, and this is 1, which is straight, then outside the horizon, it's a random walk for the causality reason that I said. Then when it comes inside the horizon, it approaches 1, but there's a critical exponent with which it approaches 1. It's 1 plus order x over t to the 2 chi, where chi is the critical exponent. And we sort of have been able to identify the critical exponent and then to estimate it, and the estimates seem to agree with the simulation. So we at least have a little bit of analytic understanding of the networks. But then when you add in loop production as a perturbation, what happens is even though the fractional dimension is approaching 1, it's not approaching it very fast. The string is still, it's approaching straight, but not very fast. And so the loop production is singular at short distance, diverges at short distance. So one can at least understand, in some ways, how you would get scales much smaller than the horizon scale, even starting from something fairly smooth. The problem is that because it diverges, we don't know what to do next. A big loop might form and then fragment into smaller and smaller and smaller, and we can wave our hands that it should stop, and we think it should stop around there. So anyway, that's what we believe, and if that's true, then okay. But again, I can't explain away the simulations that are showing larger loops. Anyway, the let's see. Just to summarize the main points, these form in a wide variety, but not a large minority of interesting unified models. In the range of tensions that we're talking about, they should show up in pulsar timing and interferometers. And if they are seen, there still is a tremendous amount of work in understanding the networks and figuring out even the basic parameters of the problem, namely, what is the string tension? What is the intercommutation probability? And also, is it possible that there's a non-standard network which has junctions or multiple kinds of string or something like that? So that's a long way off. Thank you.
Can you give a sense of how inevitable it is to have these strings, and what it is that sets the range on the GPU?
Good. So, the two big uncertainties are, one is, did inflation terminate with a phase transition of the right type? And I've, told you that cosmologists like this and string theorists like this, but that's not true. And the other, which is much more model dependent, is, can the strings break? That is, if I have a magnetic flux tube, then one normally thinks that as being topologically stable. But in grand unified models, there are also monopoles. And so a magnetic flux tube can break by formation of a monopole anti-monopole pair, just as a QCD flux tube will end by formation of a quark anti-quark pair. And so what completely controls this is the ratio of the monopole mass to the tension. If the monopole mass is greater than about 10 times the scale of the string tension, then this effectively doesn't happen. But this is such a detailed question that one can only throw up one hand and say, there are some models where it does and some where it doesn't.
If G is about 10 to the minus 7, does that translate directly into a number of radians of string in the sky?
Oh, good question. Actually, good question. I didn't ask the second half of your question, which was, where does the range of G mu come from? And again, one works backwards from delta T over T, which is observed. In any given brain inflation model, there's a definite geometry and a definite potential. And therefore, this tells you the scale of the potential. And this sets the overall normalization effectively also for the string tension. So it's working backwards from this. Now the question about the correlation between the number of radians of string, thank you, and the tension. So what I should have emphasized is this picture is independent of the tension. The tension scale, the tension doesn't affect, it just scales out of the classical action. And so this picture is, except for the possibility of the growth, except for the smallest loop, at least for the long string, the tension scales out. And so for any string tension, you're talking about, I don't know how to quote it in radians, but of order 10 to the second radians of string on the sky. So separations of a few degrees between adjacent strings.
Measuring the universe is not smooth. I mean, does the string slow down due to dynamical friction?
Very early. I mean, very early when the strings just form, the matter is very dense and there's dynamical friction. But that doesn't matter much because, again, this is an attractor solution that erases the initial conditions. Today, there's essentially no dynamical friction because these things are so relativistic, they don't feel the inhomogeneity. You had a second question?
The second one is, do I take it that the quantity of string or the number of radians of string per moving volume changes with Z or not?
Yes, it does. It's because what stays constant is the number per horizon volume. So the number per co-moving volume is going up in the past.
Yeah.
I think it's right there. Is that the right sign there? Yeah, going up. Yeah.
So is the tension changing as it radiates, as the leaf radiates?
No, just the length. The tension is a microscopic quantity that's fixed. It's only the length that's getting shorter.
Just length.
Yeah.
If you have a box where the strings don't cross the boundary, is there a well-defined helicity as there would be for magnetic flux that's conserved in time?
Well, they don't cross. Sorry.
Well, in order to try to define the helicity, you take a model, a piece of space where the strings were inside, we're not crossing the boundary.
I'm not sure what you mean by helicity. I mean, the string...
Well, like the magnetic helicity, curl A cross B, or integral A cross B.
I mean, I don't know of any real topological, except for the winding number of the string itself. I mean, this is not your earlier question about the arrow. This is not related to the arrow. It's not.
Well,
I mean, the network itself doesn't really have any interesting topological characteristics as far as I know.
If you have arrows on the strings,
yeah.
Then between two different strings, there's a linking number.
Okay, yeah. There could be linking numbers, right?
Usually what helicity is you extend the definition of linking number to the diagonal by having a framing and then you...
Oh, I see. So you say a loop has a self-linking number.
If you endow a loop with self-linking, then helicity becomes defined.
I see.
It's usually regarded as a conserved quantity under reconnection.
I see.
That's the way it works in NHD.
You know, you're taking a discrete number which is distributed along a thing light years in length. I mean, this is a pretty subtle thing for the astrophysics to see. I don't know if it's, I don't know if that would have any effect.
Does the probability have to be constant in time? The models where the probability and probability.
You know, in any microscopic model, it's a microscopic parameter, and so it's changing would be like alpha changing. You need some scalar field rolling. So P and mu you can think of as being effectively constant. Okay, cool.
Thank you.